Hello, and welcome to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the Classicist is Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Neely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, we'll take a slightly different approach to the COVID-19 story this week, starting at the state level, then moving up to the federal, and then finally the international ramifications. And we'll start close to home, which for you, of course, is California. The stats are moving pretty quickly, of course, but at this point, Victor, California looks strange compared to what might have been anticipated with this outbreak, certainly as compared to a place like New York. Explain what the situation there looks like right now and why this is a little puzzling.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I haven't looked at the statistics right this hour, but I think they're getting close to 10 times the amount of active cases in New York that has half of California's $40 million person population. And when you look at deaths, it's over 10 times lower in California than New York, even though we have twice the population. I think, I haven't checked, but this morning it was 215, 220. And so that doesn't make sense for a variety of reasons, because we were ground zero, supposedly, in Santa Clara County. We had one of the first cases after Washington, and then people did the math and they said, oh my God, LAX, SFO, San Jose, San Diego, direct flights, 12, 13 cities in China, 6, 7, 8,000 people flying in a day, LA, 3,000 visitors from China a day. So our mayor there told us, I think there were 23 direct flights in 1 month into California from Wuhan. And then when you added all that up with a lot of estimates in Italy and here that the Chinese were, of course, not sincere or accurate when they told us the first cases were not recorded to mid-December. It was more likely they knew about it in November, and the Italians believe in October. Add all that up, and we should be exploding, especially since we're not a particularly very medical astute state. We have, I think, the lowest ratio of nurses per 100,000 of the population. Same is true of doctors almost. We have really a dismal rate of beds per 1,000 Californians. Highest number of homeless, highest poverty level, most people on public assistance, most people foreign-born, 27% of the population. I could go on, but you get the impression that we should be a petri dish. And even though we have wide open spaces and we're a commuting ranch-style suburban culture, we're still ranked, I think, 11th in the country on density of population. And yet here we are with a death rate from coronavirus that's about a third what Germany is, that's being held up as a model of how to react to it. Our social distancing shutdown policy by Gavin Newsom, I think it was on March 15th or 13th, or maybe it was the 15th, but it was only 3 or 4 days before New York's, and maybe 5 or 6 from most, and it wasn't the first state. So what explains all this? And you start to look at another irony is that liberal California's medical school at Stanford, the best probably in the state, is the host for a lot of scholars who have questioned the modeling, the data, and the pessimism. And amid that optimism that they've offered, if that's the right word, is that there must have been earlier cases that we did not know about, or the disease is less infectious, or kind of emulating the Oxford researchers, that we might have had some degree of herd immunity. And that would mean that this virus was present in California from these direct flights from China for 90 days at least, and people were being infected. Some were dying and attributed to the flu. Some people were hospitalized, attributed to the flu. Some just thought they had a cold or allergies. But the result of all of that would be we have people amid us, invisible, albeit, that have some kind of immunity from it. And remember that the CDC said in November that we were one of 3 states that had an unusual influenza outbreak starting, I think, on September 28th. And they said there had been 16 outbreaks in California by the first of the year. And it was not influenza A. Everybody, I can off the tip of my top of my head, I could probably name 50 people I know that went in and actually were tested for influenza, and they all came back negative.
So, pivoting over to the national level, you wrote a column recently in which you argued that this whole crisis would be a test for President Trump of what you called his strategic foresight. So explain that concept for us, strategic foresight, and what it means in practice and what it's meant historically.
Yes, it wasn't original, the word foresight. That's just a translation of a Greek word pronoia, which means to have something in mind beforehand. And it's used by the historian Thucydides to try to make sense of the strategic cunning of Themistocles and then Pericles as well. And how he describes it is the ability of a leader to see where the country or the nation or the city-state will be in the future, adding up all of its pluses and then subtracting its minuses and seeing how wide the margin of error is and how necessary key decisions are to keep within the sidelines, so to speak, keep it in play. And I mentioned that article, people like Lincoln and Churchill, that even in the worst of times, and that would be during the Blitz or those terrible moments at Chancellorsville or Fredericksburg, they understood that when you added up industrial advantages in the case of Lincoln or population advantages, or in the case of Churchill, the British Navy or the RAF or potential allies like the Soviet Union and the United States, they could win the war when nobody thought they could, but it would require to keep that optimistic but realistic goal in mind. And they didn't give in to despair in the way that the French did. Remember, they had a larger army than the Germans in May 1940. They had better planes, they had better tanks, and they collapsed in 6 weeks. And that's, we could go on and on about nations whose leaders were not up to the task. Lyndon Johnson was not up to the task in Vietnam. It's another example.
And how does that translate to President Trump? I mean, if we were trying to apply that to what he's facing right now, what are the major considerations?
Well, he knows that we have the biggest economy, the biggest, and it was at its greatest level in history. So it was a booming economy. So he knew he had advantages, that this thing was not happening during a recession. He knew that we had the most effective and largest military. He knew we were the greatest energy and food producer, at least food producer in the sense of value of the food and diversity of it in the world. And we had, I think we're the third largest nation in the world. So we had all these, we have the best medical system, the best medical research, the top-ranked universities, cutting-edge technology in Silicon Valley, et cetera, et cetera. So he knows we have all these advantages, and he knows that we can get over it. But he has to make key decisions that don't nullify those advantages. And what is that key decision? It's focused on one big thing, so to speak, and that is there's a golden moment. I don't know where it is. He doesn't know where it is, but it exists in time and space where he's going to have to start recalibrating or shocking the American patient back into consciousness. And if he does it a little bit too early when the virus hasn't quite peaked or is slightly on the downside, then an outbreak, the renewal of an outbreak, will destroy him politically. If he waits too long, he will never get the economy in general back the way it should be during his tenure, and certainly not before the election. So what he's got to do, he's got to find a point where he says, I can get the country back, and I can explain to the American people that I am saving more lives by stopping substance abuse, depression, anxiety, suicide, destroyed lives over lost businesses, then we're now losing to the virus. And if he can articulate that and get within the parameters of that ideal date, he'll be okay. If he can't, he won't get reelected, and we won't get out of this as well.
Victor, there has been a real tug of war recently between people criticizing how the media has handled the virus, and then journalists saying, no, we've actually been heroic here. You can't trust these people in government. We're the one reliable source of information that people have had. How would you judge the media's performance thus far?
I can't think of anything they've said that's accurate. I mean, in the case of Trump, I mean, we know that if somebody drinks fish tank cleaner and it has some type of chloroquine compound in it, a poisonous one. That's not a referendum on Trump suggesting that hydrochloroquine offers medicinal advantages, and yet that's what they ran with. They ran with the hoax story that he said the virus was a hoax. He said that the hoax, the idea that he was responsible, he underestimated, was a hoax. That was a very different narrative. When you watch those press conferences, they're not even, I mean, they bear no semblance to what Obama's press conference were like in general, and particularly not during the swine flu crisis, to the degree that that administration said it was a crisis. So when I turn on the news and I read the news, I just accept that every article in some way is going to have a narrative that it's either Trump's fault or the United States. And you can see that when all of these media types were, including Hillary Clinton, were celebrating the fact that we were now America first in terms of supposed most cases. And of course, what that didn't tell the world, and they must have known that, is that we have one of the lowest death rates per capita of any country. We're in the lower rate per capita case frequency of any country. And nobody certainly would ever accept as truthful the Chinese massage statistics, which would be necessary to say the United States is number one. And then finally, why would you want to have a gleeful moment of expression when you think there's more cases in America than anywhere else? Because that would just mean that the number of people sick or dying or ill with permanent disabilities would be high, and that would be something to be bragging about. So there's something wrong with the media. It's the type of people who get attracted to it, the type of education that they're taught and they go through in journalism school, to the extent they go to journalism school, and this nexus between progressive politics and the Washington, New York corridor. You add it all up, and it's a really incubator of pathology, and I don't think anybody has much credence for it. I'm not speaking as a conservative. I'm speaking as somebody who follows the Shorenstein Center at Harvard that said 90% of its coverage of Donald Trump's administration in the first 6 months was negative. I think it's gone up to about 93. And Reuters, and they gave breakdowns, Reuters, CNN, MSNBC, Network News, New York Times, etc.
Okay, I want to close here on the international dimension. And first question on that, you pointed out recently in print just how much this crisis has exposed our international institutions, especially the EU and the World Health Organization. What have we learned about those two outfits in this process?
Well, you can't really trust any organization that doesn't have an electorate that holds it accountable. And the EU doesn't. I mean, there is an EU assembly, but it's kind of a joke. And it has no common reason to be. And by that, I mean, there is no EU language. Even their currency is not adopted by all of its members. There's no EU borders, as they bragged about. And so when push came to shove, what we found out very quickly was German bankers were not going to give reprieves to Spain, Italy, or Greece. I think Merkel said there isn't going to be any corona bonds for you people. And then borders went up, especially the Austrian border with Italy. People did not want to send Italy masks or gowns or gloves or test kits or medicines. Every single country that I know of blocked the export of hydrochloroquine because they wanted it for their own nations. What I'm getting at is there were always nations, and these ancient ties that were veneered over with EU euphemisms just dissipated. And as far as the international scene, the United Nations was like a chain that was only as strong as its weakest link, and its weakest link were dictatorships, corruption. We saw that almost immediately when the director of the World Health Organization started parroting Chinese propaganda by saying that the virus wasn't transmissible between humans. And he said that the travel ban was racist or xenophobic. And the World Health Organization has been a joke, and so I don't, as has been the United Nations. So I can't think of any transnational organization that's been of much hope. Whether we get through this with a lot of damage or a little damage will depend entirely on the wisdom of our elected officials, the leadership of Donald Trump, whether our universities and researchers are as brilliant as we're told, and how resilient is the U.S. economy, and then most importantly, how innovative, independent, self-reliant are the American people. I'm pretty confident about the last. They seem to be, you know, they're mobilizing industries to make necessary supplies and aids for the sick. You know, I'm watching right now from my farm out at the road, and it's just humming with semis going by, carrying everything. I've seen cows go by. I've seen chickens go by. I've seen whole trucks of citrus go by, and nobody's taking a break. Nobody's sequestered. Nobody's locked in their homes. And all that food is going to the East Coast for the most part, in L.A. and San Francisco.
The final question that I'll put to you, there is a lot of probably well-intentioned but utterly trite, we're all in this together talk these days, which is obviously, it's true in a certain humanitarian sense. It's not true, of course, when it comes to international politics. So what does this set of events augur for some of our rival powers, places like China or Iran or Russia?
Well, you can see that China is absolutely desperate. So it's engaging in a big gamble. It's systematically lying to the world. And it's saying to the world, in the last 2 weeks, we essentially destroyed the virus. There are no new cases. If you think that we started the virus, it was more or less the United States military. But if you think that we did, then give us credit for stopping it and aiding you. And that's a demonstrable lie. But it shows you how desperate they are, because their brand has been tarnished. And when you have countries that were recipients of Silk Road aid, like Greece or Spain or Italy, say, you know what, after this thing is over, I do not want to be reliant on the Chinese. And here in the United States, it's one of those issues that it's very rare that the left and the right line up. The left always saw China as the romantic other. You know, they weren't these alt-right white Russians that always collude, even though they colluded far more than anybody else in the world. They were sort of Mao, cherubic, nice people. They were egalitarians. They were trying to help people in Africa. They would become like Carmel if we just gave them more indulgences. And now they're sick of them because they've threatened people's health and businesses. And the corporate right is sick of them. Or if they're not sick of them, they don't think they can get away with outsourcing medical supplies or pharmaceuticals or high-tech military applicable technology. So I think China is very worried that the United States not only is going to bring back some industries, but it won't be quite the free trading colossus market that it has been in the past. And this is going to be multiplied in Europe and throughout the world. And so I think they're going to be very desperate, because they're an export-orientated country. This is the scab, to use that metaphor again, this was a scab that we tore off, and we looked at this wound and we said, oh my God, why did we have 360,000 Chinese students here that were paying and subsidizing our universities when we had a $1.6 trillion in collective student debt? Why can't we have one plant to make penicillin or amoxicillin? Why can't we get masks? And it's Americans are like that. Once they look in the mirror and say, you screwed up, you idiot, like after Pearl Harbor, obviously, but even in 1917, then we go into high gear, and we're starting to do that now. And the loser will be China, I'm pretty sure. And that's why they're gambling by lying and at such a, gosh, a global level. And it won't be hard to find out their lying if thousands of people are missing in China in the age of social media and instant communications. Even the Chinese government will have trouble censoring
and
all that.
China is the power that's most clearly in focus here, but what should we anticipate as regards Iran and Russia?
Well, we don't know anything about Russia. Putin's just instituted some draconian measure, but their attitude is, screw the world, we're not going to tell you anything about us, because if we do, it's going to show how corrupt and enfeebled we are, so we're just not going to talk about it. With Iran, remember, a lot of this depends on where you were before the crisis. Russia was in bad trouble because of the collapsing oil prices, which have only accelerated. Iran was in bad trouble because of the financial embargo, boycotts, oil markets. It killed 1,500 of its own people. Hezbollah was starving for cash. It shot down the airliner and lied about that. It lied about the coronavirus and its initial manifestations. So I think Iran is in real trouble. And it won't fall. The government won't fall during a crisis because nobody's stupid enough to destroy the government, whatever government it is, when you need something to supply medical needs of the country. But when it's over, there'll be an account. I think it was something similar to the Shah when they had that terrible earthquake in 79, and the Shah was just inept. And people didn't get rid of him, but that was one of the things that came back to haunt him a few months later. And I think the same thing's going to happen in Iran. But we'll see. And larger story is, any country that wanted to deal with China and be part of its Silk Road or its military colony or whatever relationship it had, whether that was Italy or Iran, paid a terrible price, because basically you're dealing with a pernicious, perfidious dictatorship who was perfectly willing to send hundreds or maybe thousands of its own citizens to your country when they knew that some of them were exposed to a deadly virus and they didn't really care. And that's the message the Italians are going to have to ask themselves. Was it worth it? And were the Iranians, even the Iranians, are going to have to ask that. So I think they're both injured, and I think Putin is injured. And I think China's injured, too, because they weren't in great shape before this. They were losing the trade war. And you can see that. Final thought is, we don't want to trust or believe conspiracy theories, but they're always interesting for the climate in which they sprout, and the climate in which the conspiracy theories are that China launched this virus. I don't think they did, of course, but why would the conspiracy theorists say why now? And the reason is that, then why does it spread? Because China was getting pretty desperate anyway, because they were losing this war with Donald Trump. And so that thought alone gives fuel to something that's probably untrue, but logical in the sense that they were getting desperate and angry.
You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read all of Victor's work at victorhanson.com, or you can follow him on Twitter at VDHanson. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.